All right. I'd like to thank you all for joining. This is Ori Ner with Americans for Peace Now, joining you here from Washington. And with us already on the line is our guest for today, Yossi Alfer. Yossi Alfer, you probably all know, is an independent security analyst and is the co-founder and co-editor of the Israeli-Palestinian Internet Dialogue, bitterlemons.org, and the Middle East Roundtable, bitterlemonsinternational.org. He is a former director of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, a former senior official with various security agencies in Israel, and he is also, as you probably know, the author of Hard Questions, Tough Answers, Hard Questions, Tough Answers, Peace Now's weekly analysis of the news from Israel and the region. And he's joining us to mainly analyze what is happening with the peace process at the moment. Just to let you know, is a regular guest on our study tour to Israel, on our Israel study tour. And to remind you all, this year our Israel study tour will take place in September, between September 6th and the 11th. And you're all invited to write to us if you're interested in details on it. You can write directly to me if you'd like, onir@peacenow.org. And there's some details on the tour on our website. You can find them there. So without further ado in an introduction, I'm going to ask Yossi to speak for a few minutes and just give us a kind of a current peace process horizon, and then we'll open it to Q&A. I will tell you what to do when we get to the Q&A. But if you already know that you would like to ask a question at any time, if you want to ask a question, what you do is you punch 5-star, and that signals to me that you would like to ask a question. So punch 5-star. I'll remind you of that if you get to the Q&A. Yossi, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ori, and good morning to you all. We planned this briefing some time ago at a time when it actually looked like the Israeli-Palestinian peace process mediated by Secretary of State Kerry would continue fairly smoothly into the coming months. That's not the case now. This conversation finds that process in a state of total crisis, with the negotiators for the two sides meeting almost daily in the last 3 days, but after both sides violated their commitments within the framework of a 9-month period, which has until the end of April to end. Where are we now? Well, what are the prospects now? My own sense is that given that we have a couple of weeks, including Pesach, until the so-called deadline, and given the fact that deadlines can always be extended, I think both sides having flexed their muscles and instituted their provocations, it's fairly likely that some formula will be found that will allow this process to continue. By that I mean allow a process in which the United States is using the objective of a framework agreement basically to maintain relative stability between Israelis and Palestinians, at least through the November midterm elections in the United States. I do not mean, I'm sorry to say, a process whereby there's any substantial likelihood that we'll see actual progress toward a two-state solution. We haven't seen it in the past 8 months. We have witnessed Kerry and his team, with all the huge effort they've invested, repeatedly scale down the goal from an end of claims, end of conflict, two-state solution within 9 months, that is by the end of this month, to an agreed framework, to a non-agreed framework, and now basically just to agreement to continue to talk about a non-agreed framework, with most of the talking being done by the American team with the Israeli team or with the Palestinian team, but not in genuine negotiation. So the chances of real progress are low. The chances of something that is called a process that is supposedly discussing a framework agreement, I would say, is relatively high for now, if only because all three parties have a high incentive for doing so. The Netanyahu government or Prime Minister Netanyahu, because the existence of a process allows him better to rebuff international BDS-type pressures, boycotts, and the like, or worse. The Palestinian, the PLO under Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, because he has to deal with the threat from the United States and the European Union of cutting off his financing, which would basically cause the Palestinian Authority to collapse and chaos to prevail. And, of course, Kerry and the United States, because they'd like very much, even if this process is not going to produce an agreement, the very fact of a process is certainly politically advantageous from their standpoint. Why is all this failing? Well, I'll offer two very quick thoughts, and I can expand on it later if you like. I think neither the Israeli nor the Palestinian leader, that is, neither Netanyahu nor Abbas, is really politically able to move forward toward a genuine settlement. Netanyahu has a settler-heavy government. He has his own ideological hang-ups. Abbas purports to represent the Gaza Strip, but really can't deliver it, has his own political problems at home with rivals in the Fatah movement, and has his own ideological hang-ups regarding issues like the right of return and the holy places that simply prevent any genuine agreement. I would also note that it's questionable whether it was advisable for Kerry and his team to enter into this process based on essentially a repeat of the Oslo formula, a formula that had been tried and failed with regard to a final status agreement at least twice in the course of 20 years. Nothing seems to have been learned from those failures, but we're not even getting to a position now where we can see them repeated, because so far it's all process and no substance. If I'm wrong, if this the attempts to rescue this process fail, then we may see the PLO going the UN route. We already saw Abu Mazen preempting by sending letters to 15 international institutions. There are dozens or hundreds more that he can do this with. We may see Israel respond with economic sanctions or settlements spread. These are the minimum. The big question would be whether the United States and the European Union would make good on their threat to Abu Mazen, to Abbas, that if this process fails, they're going to stop financially supporting the Palestinian Authority. It's interesting that Abbas tomorrow is appearing at a foreign ministers meeting of the Arab League in Cairo, and according to Palestinian press reports, planning to ask the Arab League to guarantee him a $100 million monthly stipend, which would presumably enable him to withstand the financial pressures of failure. I know you folks all honor your pledges to Americans for Peace Now, but you should know that the Arab League countries never honor their pledges, or certainly never 100%, and I'm sure Abbas knows this as well. In a worst case of failure, we could see intifada, we could see radical political instability in the West Bank. Either way, if the parties succeed in getting this process back on track, or if they fail, there are threats to Netanyahu's coalition, and basically everybody is threatening. Lieberman, if we free more prisoners, he wants to have new elections. Livni, if there is no process, she says the only reason I'm in this government is for a peace process. Bennett on the far right, if anything else is done with the Palestinians, wants to pull out. Now, these all may be just for the sake of political bluster, but it certainly the outcome in the near term could have an effect on the stability of Netanyahu's coalition. To conclude, just a word about the international backdrop to all of this, because it's very important to keep it in mind, and I'm referring to two issues. One is the Arab revolutions, which are still in progress in Syria, of course, in Egypt, looking toward new elections, in Libya, Syria overflowing into Lebanon. That's two of our borders on the north. What's going on in the Arab world and the great instability in the Arab world means that it's rather hard for Kerry to think about even recruiting pressure from the Arab world or incentives or sanctions from the Arab world as a means of keeping this process alive and perhaps making something out of it. On the other hand, there is a broad phenomenon throughout the region, Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, phenomenon of a U.S. loss of credibility. And U.S. credibility in the region is down because all those who are against Iran are not happy with the U.S. negotiations with Iran. The failure of the administration to back up its red line on Syrian chemical weapons, incidentally, according to Israeli reports, Syria has used chemical weapons again twice in the past 2 weeks. And most recently, the Crimea crisis, where the U.S. is perceived in the region as having backed away from guarantees for for Ukraine and for Ukrainian sovereignty in Crimea. We see what's going on in the rest and eastern Ukraine now with Russian incitement. If more happens, and again the U.S. backs away or is seen to back away, and I say is seen because it's quite clear to me the Obama administration has perfectly rational explanations for most of the actions that are being criticized in the region. In some cases, these actions, like the negotiations with Iran, are actually beneficial. But that's not the way they're seen here. And this is across the region, across borders, Israelis, Arabs, I dare say that last week both Netanyahu and Abu Mazen felt a little bit freer to tweak the nose of the United States by taking provocative actions, settlement building, refusing to release prisoners, trying to join international organizations, breaking their word to the United States. They felt a little freer to do it because of the perception that the U.S. won't do anything about it, that Obama and Kerry will simply, in the end, back down, won't react, won't punish anybody. That's a sour note to end this little presentation on, but I think it's very important to emphasize it. So that concludes what I have to say by way of opening remarks, and I'd be happy to hear your questions about these and related issues.
Thank you very much, Yossi. To ask a question, people should dial 5 star 5 followed by the star key. And what I will do is there will be a queue. I will call on you by unmuting you. When I unmute you, you will hear a certain message saying that you've been unmuted, and you will know that you're next in line to ask a question. So 5 star is the way to do it. Maybe I'll start, Yossi, by just asking you really quickly how all this is playing out in Israel with Israeli public opinion. I'm looking at today's Peace Index poll, which was just published, and I see that, you know, the same pattern that we've seen for a long, long time of support for negotiations, the 66% who support continuing the negotiations, alongside a great deal of pessimism, somewhere in the 80% of people saying that they don't expect anything to come out of the negotiations. So maybe just if you can just characterize how this is playing out on the political scene, and even more so just in terms of the public scene, the public opinion in Israel.
Well, I saw that poll too, Ori, and it basically confirmed my own impressions. This crisis has done nothing to reduce overall Israeli support for a two-state solution and for a process, but it certainly has done something to increase Israeli skepticism and pessimism about whether that's doable. I would say even before this crisis of the past week, the performance of this 8-month peace process was enough to discourage a lot of Israelis. And by the way, Palestinian public opinion is something of a mirror image in terms of the pessimism issue. Now, translated into politics, as I noted, this crisis has had a kind of destabilizing effect on the coalition, at least at the rhetorical level. The threats to pick up and leave by the far right if the process goes ahead, by the center if the process doesn't go ahead. It's a good opportunity for the opposition led by Labor Party leader Herzog to score some points as well, and he's even been threatening to try to set up an alternative coalition. For example, if he could persuade Livni with her 7 mandates and Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid's party with the 20 mandates, to leave the coalition together and join him. I don't think it's going to happen. This coalition has only been around for about just over a year. Everybody's just settling into their ministries, into their perks. That's a major deterrent to a crisis. And I think it's going to take more than this to really destabilize this government. But who knows? A lot doesn't depend on Israel. A lot depends on Mahmoud Abbas and what he decides to do, and whether he wants to extend or even amplify this crisis, as well as on the way the United States and even the Europeans react. So we'll wait and see. I can only repeat my basic assessment that it's more likely that we'll weather this crisis and something called a peace process will continue to exist, and that the various components of the Netanyahu coalition will swallow hard, hunker down, and hang around.
Thank you, Yossi. Just to remind people, the way to ask a question is to dial 5 star 5 followed by the star key. Our first question comes from Jim Klutznik, the chairman of our board of directors. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, thank you, Ori. Yossi, as you stated previously, that nothing seems to have been learned from previous failures during negotiations within the context of the Oslo framework. Could you describe to us an alternative or alternative frameworks for the U.S., to try to act as an honest broker to negotiate with these two parties?
Good question, Jim. And if you have a spare 2 hours, I can expand on this.
I do.
There's a lot to be said. But let me begin with this. One source of disappointment that I have with the Kerry effort, and I say this with the greatest admiration for the guy and for the huge amount of personal and institutional resources he's devoted to this, is that it doesn't appear that it began with a systematic effort to study the successes and failures of the past 20 years. And I say that because it ended up simply taking the Oslo Declaration of Principles menu for final status, a menu that the parties had completely failed to agree on at the highest level twice, at Camp David in July 2000 with Barak and Arafat under President Clinton, and in 2008 when Olmert met repeatedly with Abu Mazen, again under the tutelage of the Bush administration. These were the attempts at the highest level, at the summit level, to deal with the Oslo Manual final status issues, and they failed. And my sense is that you had to begin by asking yourself why, rather than saying, I'm just going to repeat what they did, I'll do it better. But this is what we've seen, repeating what they did and doing it better and very quickly realizing it's not going to work and backtracking because Kerry didn't seem to have a plan B. What could a plan B be at this point in time? Conceivably, and you see this proposed from many corners of Israeli political society, left and right, encouraging some sort of unilateral move by Israel, some sort of unilateral withdrawal from another portion of the West Bank, perhaps, or some sort of interim agreements between the two sides, although the Palestinians are dead set against them. At the broader level, if someone is wants to think about trying this again a few months or even years from now, my own sense is that you have to draw two main conclusions from the failure of Oslo to deliver a final status agreement, again, twice at the highest level. One is that the whole Oslo process, for lack of an alternative, puts at the table a sovereign country, Israel, and a 1950s-style national liberation movement, the PLO. There's a basic imbalance here. And the PLO, what's important to recognize here is that it is with the PLO that we negotiate, not with the Palestinian Authority. And the PLO, Abu Mazen heads both of these institutions, the PLO represents not just the Palestinians who live in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. It represents the entire Palestinian diaspora, which is even larger. And Abbas doesn't dare make any decisions, for example, on the right of return issue, for fear of what his diaspora constituency will say. So there's a huge imbalance here. And this is one problem. The second is that if you take a good look at the Oslo menu of final status issues, it lists together post-1967 issues like borders, settlements, security, sovereignty, a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, with pre-1967 narrative issues like the right of return and the fate of the holy places, in particular the Temple Mount. In this context, you have to recognize that the emergence of the Jewish state, a negotiating demand by Israel, it emerged before Netanyahu, but has been embraced by Netanyahu, is very much, in terms of the public's emotional reaction, very much a response to the very, very extreme Palestinian position on the narrative issues. One lesson that I think could be drawn from 20 years of failure is that you have to separate out these issues. Something Kerry didn't try to do. If you look at what we know about his framework agreement, or his draft framework agreement, the first thing he did is put on a Jewish state. And then he tried to balance this with the 1967 lines. Now, he's taking a narrative pre-67 issue, Jewish state, which is a response to Palestinian narrative positions, and trying to balance it with a post-67 very pragmatic nuts and bolts issues. It's no wonder it didn't work. We can consider whether it was wise to adopt the Jewish state issue, but my point is there doesn't seem to have been the kind of homework that I would like to have seen, the kind of preparations I would like to have seen to produce a more viable process and one that doesn't simply embrace the Oslo format, the Oslo mode, but tries to develop something new. And as I said, I don't see a plan B of trying to do that either.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Martin Bressler, our former chairman of the board.
Hi, Yossi. My question is a narrow one as opposed to Jim's, and that is we hear people here saying that Israel did not break its agreement to release the prisoners, that there are reasons why it was not bound by that agreement. Is it clear in your mind that Israel did indeed break its agreement?
Well, you've got to go and look at the timeline here, Marty. Mahmoud Abbas reacted by signing those 15 letters to the UN-linked international institutions when it was clear to him that Netanyahu was delaying cabinet approval of the last tranche, the fourth tranche of 26 prisoners. Abbas would argue Netanyahu broke the agreement, and therefore I broke the agreement. Netanyahu would argue I didn't break the agreement, I just delayed our decision, and Abbas broke the agreement. It's clear that Netanyahu had huge reservations about this fourth and final group of prisoners. He had committed in advance when this process began to release them, and to release them at the end of March. And by as we approach the end of March, he began to say, one, I didn't realize this would include Arab citizens of Israel, and I propose to replace them with others. Of course, the Palestinians had a list of names, and they considered this violation of the agreement, too. And two, he said, why should I release the fourth tranche if the Palestinians aren't planning to continue as the Americans have agreed? This is what brought about this very hasty American mediation effort that brought in issues like a semi-settlement freeze. Netanyahu will release another 400 somewhere down the line, and Pollard will be released. Something that Kerry evidently proposed. It's not at all clear to me to what extent the President Obama and the American security community have actually agreed to this. But where things were when this crisis broke was that Netanyahu was saying, well, okay, if I get Pollard, I can get my cabinet to agree to the Israeli Arabs and even to 400 more and maybe to some kind of very modest freeze on new construction initiatives. If, of course, Abu Mazen agrees not to go to the international community and to continue this process for many more months. I would say both parties violated the agreement, violated their commitments to Kerry. They're both equally responsible, but you certainly can't blame it all on Israel. You can't absolve Abu Mazen of taking what is obviously a very provocative step and one that is not acceptable not only to Jerusalem but to Washington as well. So to get this back on track, you've got to roll all that back. You've got to roll back those 15 letters. You've got to roll back the latest. I didn't mention the Israeli provocation of releasing a communique about new building in East Jerusalem, also at a particularly sensitive time. You've got to roll that back too, and then you've got to see, and then you've got to go back to the issue of prisoner release in order to get this moving again. And then, of course, the issue of all the additional prisoners and the Pollard issue are likely to come back into focus, or perhaps the negotiators will find some alternative direction to move in terms of confidence building to get this going again.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Dan Fleshler, another board member, to ask the next question. Before I do that, though, just one quick comment, Yossi, and you may want to refer, maybe fold in the answer to this to your remarks later on. One thing that I think Kerry did do that was different from the Oslo process was trying to take the security issue off the table early on with the security plan that he brought in. So that was something that he tried to do differently, perhaps. But you may want to talk about that later. Dan Fleshler?
Well, if the Palestinians go to the UN, short of going to the International Criminal Court, but applying for all those various conventions, the U.S. has already said it's very unhappy about it. It's opposed. It's not the right move. I find it impossible to come up with a reason why they shouldn't do that, or why it would be very harmful for them to do that. IPN and other groups are going to be under a certain amount of pressure probably to figure out what to do today about the Palestinian application of the Human Rights Convention. Is there any credible reason why it's harmful for them to do that, aside the fact that Israel just doesn't like it?
It's not just Israel, it's the United States. I mean, the United States has stuck, we can argue whether this is a wise position or not, but the United States and Israel, when it comes to the international institutions, and has used its veto in the Security Council and so on and so forth. So it has made it very clear it doesn't approve of this track. One area in which this would be harmful to the Palestinian cause is losing American support, American cooperation, American financial aid, and perhaps that of the European Union as well, because the European Union, or most of the European countries, tend to look to Washington for their cue on issues relating to the Palestinians and the United Nations. Secondly, they go to the International Criminal Court, other bodies, and they level charges against Israel for war crimes and the like. None other than Naftali Bennett, the most far-right minister in this government, has said quite correctly from the Israeli standpoint, we can do this too. The minute Palestine is recognized as a state by the International Criminal Court, we've got plenty to accuse them of. There are plenty of violations of human rights, of the laws of war, and so on and so forth. Don't forget, Abu Mazen purports to be responsible for what happens in Gaza as well. These guys are shelling Israeli civilians repeatedly. It can turn into a pretty nasty sort of all-out tit-for-tat of leveling accusations back and forth. Exactly what will come out of it, I don't know, but it won't necessarily serve just the Palestinian cause, although obviously large portions of the international community and the BDS campaign will draw encouragement from the Palestinians doing this and increase their efforts to isolate Israel. So the question really is, to what extent will they succeed on balance in using this strategy to isolate Israel? And beyond the satisfaction this will give them, will this in any way be translated into gains on the ground? Because in retaliation, Israel will seal the borders, stop transferring Palestinian tax money. Israel can cut off electricity, water. It can almost overnight bring the whole Palestinian Authority to its knees if it chooses to do so. So this is a dicey their part, and it's a pity that it got to this, because I think one of the alternatives, one of the plan Bs, could have been to look at what the kind of recognition the Palestinians want internationally for a state, and see if this could be a leveraged into a kind of win-win UN resolution that would give them a state, but would give Israel sufficient guarantees to continue negotiating, this time on a more level playing field with a Palestinian state, and with significant international backing for its own needs. Again, that was never considered by the United States, and I doubt very much it's going to be considered now.
Thank you. Next to ask a question is Ted Lieberman.
Thank you, Ori. I think this question follows very closely on Yossi's last answer. I'm looking at the list of the 15 conventions that the PLO has agreed to sign on to, and they seem to be things that we would normally say are very positive. The conventions on treatment of prisoners, the laws and treaties of war, the law of treaties and so forth. I'm wondering, Yossi, if you think that the part of the message of Abbas's signature on these treaties was to show not just that they're not willing to sit around forever, but also that they're willing to accept certain international norms by putting their name on the dotted line to give comfort to the international community, that they understand that they're now responsible for obeying the laws of the treatment of prisoners and so on. Is it possible that there was also a positive intent in this move?
Well, I suppose, I don't know how they chose the 15. There are hundreds, apparently, of such conventions that Palestine can theoretically sign on to. I don't know how they...
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN talked about 500 or something like that.
Yeah. And why they chose these 15, because they're relatively innocuous, because they're motherhood and apple pie. I don't know. What's more, it takes several months to process the Palestinian request, so it can be withdrawn at any time in the coming weeks. I don't see any evidence in West Bank society that Abbas government in the PA are moving toward abiding more closely by international norms. Abbas is under tremendous political pressure within Fatah from the Mohammed Dahlan faction. He has been known to imprison journalists for criticizing him. There are serious incitement problems. There are other serious human rights problems, to say nothing about all the Hamas guys that are arrested in the middle of the night, either by them or by us based on tips that we get from them. If he really ends up joining these conventions, and again, if Israel decides to fight back by holding him to the language of the conventions, which is, of course, a dicey tactic, then it could be very interesting. But I know of no, I don't recall seeing any Palestinian declarations to the effect that they're trying to send a positive signal that they want to abide by all these conventions and that's a positive change in the way they go about doing business. I haven't seen it.
Thank you. The next question will come from Mr. Shlinsky in California.
Hi, it's actually Ira Udovan. I'm using Evely's phone. We're using Evely's phone. Two questions. I'll ask them briefly. First of all, we on the left have tended to shy away from even oppose moves by the American Jewish community and some of its organizations to encourage pressure President Obama to toughen his stance on things like sanctions and so forth. To reconsider that somewhat. Secondly, there's a whole lot of talk about a new configuration in the Middle East, Sunni versus Shiite, and Israel is supposed to be discovering a new host of new best friends. Is there substance in that, and what's being done to advance it?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood either question. You're asking whether to encourage the Obama administration to pressure Israel to invoke sanctions against Israel?
No. To the pressure is for the Obama administration to become more assertive in Crimea, against Iran, and so forth. The left, the American left, has mostly said, leave him alone, let him go, let him proceed. If the United States has a credibility problem, perhaps might not we reconsider that our position and work to...
Okay, let me dispense with that just by saying I want to suffice with telling you folks how it's seen from here. And from here I mean not just Israel, but Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, the Emirates, and so on. What you do with that, how you factor that piece of information into your policy decisions, I don't think I should... express myself about. Now, the second one, you were asking if there's some sort of alliance between Israel and Shiites. Did I hear
you
right?
I hear a lot about a new configuration or the crystallization of an existing configuration in the Middle East, which becomes Shiite versus Sunni. And Israel then becomes an ally of the Sunni faction, Saudi Arabia and so forth. Is this indeed happening? And is there anything let's leave it at happening, because the best thing to do is on things like that is not to ask for specifics.
Okay. A lot is written about this, because it's very easy to find the common points between the Saudi position and the Israeli position with regard to Iran, or even Bashar al-Assad looking at the Alawites as a kind of branch of Shia Islam. Israel finds itself under attack by both extremist Shiites and Sunnis alike. Extremist Shiites led by Iran, and of course you have Hezbollah, which is now active in this war in Syria and on the Syrian Golan front against Israel, but Sunnis as well. And some of these Sunnis, in effect, grew up in Saudi Arabia. And I'm talking about Al-Qaeda and various Salafi groups whom we encounter in southern Syria today, but also in the Sinai, where we find ourselves quietly cooperating militarily with the Egyptians, who are Sunnis, in dealing with Sunni extremists in the Sinai Peninsula and on Israel's border, and in dealing with Sunni extremist Hamas in the Gaza Strip as well. Yes, there is room to speculate that Israel and Saudi Arabia have something to talk about, and Israel and the Emirates have something to talk about. Israel and Jordan have more openly something to talk about when it comes to Iran, when it comes to the Alawites and their Iranian and Hezbollah supporters in Syria. How far this sort of cooperation goes is mainly a matter of speculation. It's quite clear that with Jordan, cooperation, to the extent it exists, focus on southern Syria, where Salafi elements can threaten both countries on their borders with Syria. But beyond that, there may be some intelligence exchange, but I think we have to bear in mind that there is no great commonality here between Israel and Saudi Arabia, or Israel and the entire Sunni community. We are fighting Sunnis, some of them financed by Saudis, and so there are things to talk about in both directions, if you like, to the extent the two parties are talking. Obviously, from Israel's standpoint, it's convenient and congenial to see ourselves more or less in the same camp as a host of Sunni countries, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, perhaps somewhere places in North Africa as well. But it's also, I think, important to keep in mind, and the Saudis never fail to remind you of this, that any more open cooperation is dependent on progress on the Palestinian issue. They cannot, from the standpoint of their publics, allow themselves to come out in the open with anything looking like a commonality of views with Israel until and unless there's some genuine progress on the Palestinian issue. That doesn't preclude military cooperation with Egypt and with Jordan, but it certainly does preclude anything that could be called normalization with those countries, to say nothing of even any kind of overt relations whatsoever with countries like Saudi Arabia.
Thank you, Yossi. We have about 15 minutes late, and we have at least four people who have been waiting very patiently to ask questions. What I suggest, Yossi, is that we take two batches of two questions each, and maybe end with that, unless there is someone with another burning question. So the two will, in that order, will be Mr. Schneiderman, Ben Schneiderman, and then Michael Sebrel. Mr. Schneiderman?
I wanted to ask the question about the American loss of influence in the region and its impact on the negotiation, which you had cited earlier. I take it from your earlier answer that you're not prepared to discuss what American policy ought to be. If you are prepared to do that, what is it that you see as a prestige-enhancing action by the United States in the region that would have a positive impact on the negotiation?
And then Michael Sebrell?
I would like to ask...
Hello. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Michael. Yeah. I forgot the rules.
I'd like to ask a question about the relationship between the prisoner release and the resistance to going to the international conventions and agreements. It is my understanding that there was an agreement in which Israel would release 110 Palestinians in four batches by March 29th, and Palestine agreed that they would not go to the international community for recognition. The tie-in was specifically between those two points, and that Israel did not release the prisoners, the last batch, by March 29, which nullified the agreement. So Palestine went to the did what they said they were going to do. Is that understanding incorrect, or is it simple, or is it?
Let me start with that, Michael. It's not incorrect, but there are nuances here. To begin with, the agreement had been, yes, four prisoner releases, a total of 104. That was 26 times 4, with the last one by March 29th. And the Palestinians would not go to the international community after the nine-month period. Okay? So, yes, Netanyahu was fudging the date. Yes. But he hadn't said no. He was trying to find a way to come through with this. And he may be excused if he thought he had a few more weeks, even, say nothing of days, to get this done before Abbas would take this extreme step, to the extent it is an extreme step, of going to the international community. It's also in violation in the sense that he had committed to talk for 9 months. He had committed to postpone going to the international community for 9 months. As I said, they're both violating. And the fact that they, and this gets to the first question, the fact that they could allow themselves to do this, so blatantly ignore their commitments to the Obama administration, it seems, among other things, there are many factors here, but among other things, to reflect a sense that with the drop in the U.S. role in the Middle East and U.S. credibility, they can get away with it. So that brings me back to the first question. Again, I'm not comfortable telling you folks what American policy should be. What I can say is that it's important for the administration to recognize this loss of credibility. I think it does. I think that explains, for example, Obama's recent trip to Saudi Arabia, where he went to reassure them with regard to Iran, with regard to the Syrian issue, with regard to the peace process. It's important to recognize that if indeed there is this loss of credibility, and if it could even get worse, and again, I mentioned what the Russians appear to be cooking up now in eastern Ukraine, this could have serious ramifications for American policy in the Middle East. Now, bear in mind that the Obama administration has made no secret of the fact that it is to a large extent withdrawing from the Middle East and that it's not interested in any more military involvement in the Middle East after Afghanistan and Iraq. And my impression is that in this policy it has fairly far-reaching support of the American public.
go back to September, I think it was September 18th, the Obama speech at the UN General Assembly, when he said very clearly, we have two, but in effect only two, priorities in the Middle East. The negotiations with Iran over the nuclear project and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. He did not mention Syria. He did not mention Egypt. He did not mention the Gulf. And it's important to note that he stated that right up front. Now, if you look at these two priorities and where the administration has gone with them, well, the negotiations with Iran are progressing. And there are even predictions that they'll manage to avoid having to even extend the six-month deadline. But in dire contrast, the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations are going nowhere. So what the administration does with this and how it does with it and to what extent it factors in the credibility issue, which I emphasize is a background issue. It's not that I wouldn't dare say it's the primary reason for this crisis. I don't know, and it's complicated because obviously the administration has a lot of alternative priorities as midterm elections approach.
Thank you, Yossi. We'll take another batch of two questions and end with that to keep our promise to you to let you go at the top of the hour. So in the following order, Stephen Levy and Alan Feldman.
Yes, thank you, Yossi. I was wondering if you thought that the left had a chance of gaining power with dissolution of the coalition if the left, the Herzog in particular, but maybe Livni and Lapid, would come out strongly in favor of certain points that might get the 66% to vote for them and support them. In particular, I'm thinking on the Jordan Valley question, security. That was not an issue I understood before back in 2000 or 2008. It's only a Netanyahu issue. And the Americans have indicated they'd be willing to put security forces there. So Netanyahu insists, no, it has to be Israeli soldiers. But if the left came out and said, no, we can be hands there, be Americans there, maybe that would help gain support for the left. And also a promise to reimburse the settlers on leaving the West Bank when and if a solution is reached. Do you think the left, if they said something like that, might help gain support for a new government?
Thank you, Stephen. And then Alan Feldman.
Thank you, Yossi and Ori, both of you. Yossi, earlier you were wrestling with the issue of what do we do if what is an alternative starting point for negotiations if and when these negotiations and the whole Oslo process is put aside. And a couple of weeks ago I was in meetings led by Herb Kelman at Harvard and Jerome Siegel, University of Maryland, and others, in which they were talking about an alternative to the strict separation and some what they call the common homeland paradigm, where there's one homeland with two states within it. Is that a starting point from your point of view? Does that open up any new possibilities?
Okay, last two questions. Stephen, speculation about what policies the Israeli left could adopt in order to increase its attractiveness to the voter has to take into account that certainly the last election, and certainly to, I would say probably today as well, and with all due respect to that poll that Ori mentioned in the beginning, which came out today, which focuses only on reactions to this crisis in the peace process, what Israelis are the issues that Israelis are going to vote on primarily are not the peace process. They are not relations with the Palestinians. They are social and economic issues primarily, and issues like religion and state, burden sharing in the army, and so forth. This is what the election was fought on a year and a quarter ago. And as matters stand, unless this crisis with the Palestinians turns into an armed conflict, unless we are again visited by suicide bombers and the like, as matters stand, if the left wants to improve its standing with the voters,
It has to do it mainly based on economic, social, and if you like, legal issues like burden sharing. Ori, I'm harking back here to something you mentioned earlier about the Jordan Valley.
Right.
Yes, Kerry began by with the security issue in the Jordan Valley, but their proposal was roundly rebuffed by a lot of people who said, we need, going back even to Rabin, we need Israeli forces in the Jordan Valley, not international forces. Now, here again, I come back to the issue of American credibility. In Israeli eyes, in the eyes of the Israeli army or of any Israeli government, if the U.S. cannot be relied on to back up its red line with regard to chemical weapons in Syria, if it cannot be relied on to back up its red line with regard to Crimea, can we put our trust and sign a peace treaty and put our trust in American commitments with regard to Israel's security based in the Jordan Valley? This has now become a serious issue. And there certainly is less and less inclination to adopt a position based on these sort of American security guarantees. The settler reimbursement proposal, well, it's been on the books for a long time. The left has tried to pass it. Everybody knows where the left stands on this. It hasn't changed the prospects of the Labor Party to rise in popularity. And certainly, if elections were held today, we would almost certainly see another Netanyahu government. Aaron, an alternative negotiating starting point, one homeland, two states. I know this from Jerome Siegel. I didn't know Herb Kelman did it. You know, what does it mean, one homeland, two states? Either you have two separate states or you have one so-called homeland where everybody's together. Is this sort of moving towards some kind of a one-state solution and looking for all kinds of nuanced ways to distinguish between the two? I've even seen proposals that say there'll be no borders. We'll all live happily between the river and the sea, but Israelis will somehow identify themselves as part of an amorphous Israeli state and Palestinians as part of an amorphous Palestinian state. Frankly, I don't think these ideas work. A two-state solution will be extremely difficult to implement today. It will be extremely difficult to maintain. It's still the best idea. I don't agree with those who say that if this present process fails, it's finished, and we're heading willy-nilly toward an apartheid state. I recall those who, when Oslo began in September 1993, immediately proclaimed that this is irreversible, we're on track to a two-state solution, nothing can stop it. Well, we saw that it can be stopped, and we saw it can be revived. And the same is true of today of the two-state solution. But I think the basic outlines of a two-state solution are still the ones that that should be guiding us if we're going to at all move in that direction. And I fully agree with those who point out that the more settlers there are in the West Bank, and the more failures we have, the worse the situation, and the more difficult will be to promulgate a two-state solution. This, by the other, is another, or should have been another reason for Kerry to think twice about starting a process if he's not pretty sure that it's going to succeed, because every failure makes it that much more difficult for the next time. But I don't. When I talk about alternative negotiating starting points, my inclination is to think about either ways to co-opt the Palestinian UN initiative and turn it into a win-win proposition, or to think of ways for Israel to carry out some sort of additional unilateral withdrawal on the West Bank, something that will give breathing space to the process for several years while we get organized and do it, and perhaps instill some new optimism into the prospects of ultimately drawing reasonable lines between the two sides. And with that, folks, thank you very much, and I wish everybody Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Yossi. Thank you very much for joining us. People are encouraged to keep following Yossi's analysis on our website in his weekly column, Hard Questions, Tough Answers. This week's column will be pushed out in our weekly update either today or tomorrow. Thank you again to all of you. Chag Sameach, happy Passover, and we'll see you soon in our next briefing call. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hello?
The host has joined the conference.